Welcome to episode 19 of the Ikivi podcast. In this episode, we have with us Lydia Morrow. Lydia is a knitter, designer, artist, stylist, model, and sometimes influencer with a special interest in ethical fashion. She is passionate about creating a more just, equal, and diverse fashion industry that is less harmful to people and the environment through an understanding of the intersectional issues that affect it. She loves inspiring people to make their own clothes, get creative, and get a better understanding of their own style. We talk about the deep relationship between an individual's personality and their choice of clothing, as well as her style of dressing and her process as a stylist. We also discuss with her in this conversation the socio-economic problems that currently prevent inclusivity in the fashion industry, where we stand, where it is that we need to be, and how we can come one step closer to reaching there. So, hi, Lydia. We're so excited to have you on the podcast today. We absolutely love your voice and all that you do, and we're excited to have this conversation with you. To start things off, I'd really like to address how enjoyable and playful and celebratory your style is, and that really comes across on your social media as well as with, you know, even in conversations that we've had before, like it just comes across to us. Can you tell us a little bit about your journey with fashion and when it all began?
Yeah, thank you. I think the playfulness for me has always been there, and I've always kind of wanted to express that. I've always felt like I was a bit of a strange kid and like enjoyed expressing my like difference through fashion, but it's definitely only really come into its own since having a kid. And I think there's like a lot of elements of that, like that instinct to dress playfully that were kind of hampered by feeling very, very insecure in myself and in my body. And even at, like, not everyone listening will know, but I am a fat person, and that was not the case for me for my whole life, but I have struggled with body image issues my whole life, even when I wasn't a fat person. And that really, really like had me in a bit of a stranglehold in terms of like what I felt comfortable wearing, what I felt comfortable being perceived as, and all of these things. And then after having my son, I was like suddenly having to reckon with suddenly becoming fat and becoming disabled and all of these things. And I had to kind of made a conscious choice where I was like, you know what, like I have so many things working against me right now that are so difficult. And I was struggling so much with postpartum depression and things like that. And I was like, I'm going to let go of this thing that's controlling me right now and just dress in a way that makes me feel joyful. And it just makes such a huge difference. It's very freeing. And I feel like in some ways, like I think when you're a young adult, you think of maturing your style, quote unquote, as like a positive thing and like a sign of maturity. And I'm realizing now, you know, that's actually a little bit of naivety about what it is to be an adult. And like what it is to be an adult is to be able to have the space to be yourself. And I'm realizing, you know, I'm growing up. I'm like, oh, as I grow up, I can dress as silly as I want, which is kind of the opposite of how society frames that. So yeah. That's kind of my more recent journey with fashion.
Yeah. Have you always been interested in fashion?
Yeah, it's always been a way that I've like taken a lot of pleasure in expressing myself. Like my family were really artistic. Like my dad was in a punk band and my mom was an artist. And like that was obviously like quite often expressed through fashion. And then like we were very poor, and so we were getting all of our clothes secondhand and stuff like that. And so there was a lot of like, because we couldn't buy the clothes that we wanted, we were always dyeing them the right colors, or, you know, adding patches or embroideries or things like that. So like the creativity towards wearing the clothes has always been there. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, it's obviously looked very different through the years.
Yeah. It definitely has kind of taken different shapes and forms. How does it feel for you to kind of dress uniquely you in society? How does it feel for people? Do you feel accepted in society? Is it something that you feel like you're strongly pushing against? How does it feel to really choose and, you know, be in your own style?
This is an interesting question, because as you're saying it, I'm like, I am not 100% sure, because what's happened in my case is I've started doing this when Ransom was born. That's my son's name. And obviously in the first few years of having a baby, you don't go out that much. And then it's been COVID. So like, to be honest, I feel like most of my experience of people seeing me out is actually just on the internet. So obviously that has been a very positive response. But I don't really know. I mean, I'm neurodivergent. I have ADHD, and I think that I likely have autism. And something that's quite common in my friends' experiences who also are neurodivergent is this feeling of like wanting to dress in a way that that explains yourself, or like shows exactly who you are as a person, mm-hmm. but then simultaneously really not wanting to be perceived very much. So it's kind of, it ends up with this funny conundrum that you're dressing very loud or dressing very unique, and people look at you all the time. But then you're like, no, don't look at me. I don't want to be seen. And it's not from a place of like self-consciousness. It's from a place of like, I don't know, like struggling to perceive yourself as a person. I don't know. It's a very interesting dichotomy. And I thought it was just me, but the more friends that I've made who have the similar things, similar diagnoses, they all speak of the same weird experience. So it's kind of funny. I'm like, I don't know what that is. But yeah. I like feeling like sometimes my favorite thing is sometimes like a child will look at me in this like odd way. Like when I had pink hair and I was wearing like I was wearing a pink and blue tulle skirt with like a pink top. And this girl was just looking at me like, whoa. And you could tell that she was like, I didn't know that adults really could look this way. And I'm like, oh, that's really fun. Like, I think it feels exciting that like that children can get excited about the way that I'm dressing.
Yeah. Can you tell us a little bit about all the work that you do within the fashion industry, or in general, if there's anything else that you do?
Like in terms of my job and my Instagram kind of stuff?
Yeah. So on your Instagram, I think you've mentioned designer, you've mentioned stylist, mm-hmm. a bunch of other things. Can you just run us through that and what you do? Yeah.
So like since just a little bit before COVID, I decided to stop. I was making underwear. And I decided to stop doing that and just like focus on sort of general freelancing. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, people ask me to describe my job and I'm like, well, it's kind of whatever happens to be going and whatever happens to take my interest at the time. But that keeps it really interesting and fresh. So I do some knitwear design, like as an artist, like just making pieces as like part of a fine art practice. And I do some design, like very occasionally on commissions for people. I am working right now on some knitting patterns, which is so much more difficult than I thought it would be. As someone who makes up my own patterns for knitting, writing it down in a way that other people can understand, whew, it's tough.
Yeah.
And then, I like do some styling. some consulting. I do some consulting for brands who want to extend their size range. And I'm sure there's even more things that I do. I just have, I have this Instagram, which is like relatively successful. And through that, I'm connected quite a lot with like probably the majority of brands who are ethical or interested in ethical production and size inclusion. And so through that, I get a lot of like little funny little odd jobs. And sometimes I get work doing like what I'm cringe to my very core to say is influencing. but just like, you know, creating content or like photographs for people's websites or making a little post about their business. But like with a heavy focus on like the ethical fashion industry. So it's all over the place, but it's quite fun. And it's kind of all tied in with the obviously unpaid work that I do kind of in my social media in general, just like advocating for change towards ethical fashion and changes in the industry and changes in the way that we consume and produce stuff. So yeah, it's fun. No 2 days are the same.
Yeah. So with styling in that you've mentioned, and you help people with styling and things like that, one of the things with sustainability is also kind of figuring out your own style. So you know, when you are buying pieces, you're consciously buying something that, you know, you will use several times. So it's very like chosen, the kind of pieces that go into your wardrobe and kind of putting together your wardrobe. Is that mm-hmm. something you help people with? And if you do, how is it? How does one kind of put their wardrobe together? I find that very challenging myself. Like it's very difficult to decide on a particular style and kind of stick with it. So you tend to like buy something that will just not work, but it'll be sitting in your wardrobe for like days and years and months. How does one kind of figure out their own style?
Oh, I wish I could do, I like styling is one of my favorite things and I wish I could do more of it. Basically, like, to be fair, I'm trying to think of a way to explain this to other people, but a lot of what I do when I'm thinking about styling other people is quite like intuitive based on my understanding of their style and like long conversations about what they like. But like, I don't know, what I try to aim for, right, is like finding the kind of essence of what they like in terms of like, we talk about what kind of like movements, what kind of cultures, and like, you know, if somebody's into Western wear or like 1980s jumpsuits or things like that, like these kind of like core things that they find really joyful that they maybe feel are a little too wild for their style. And then we kind of work from there on finding where their comfort level is. So I do think what's really difficult for people, and what I try to do a little bit when I'm styling people, is a combination of these two things. So a lot of the time people, you know, for example, they like Western wear, but they don't want to dress like a full cowboy. And so we work together on finding where, from the point of like normal clothes inspired by Western wear to full cowboy, they are comfortable with. But then also working through like, if they're mostly only comfortable on the most muted end of that, how much of that is about their self-esteem and how much is it about not feeling comfortable, and how much of that is something that they want to hold on to, and mm-hmm. how much of that is something they want to let go of. And I think that's an important thing when you're really thinking about your style, is like identifying where the points are that you are holding on to a style rule because of fear, rather than holding on to it because it's genuinely something you care about. Like maybe you just don't like yellow, or maybe somebody told you that you shouldn't wear yellow for your skin tone. Mm, and those, yeah, those are the points where I'm like, okay, so where does this instinct come from? Is that your preference, or is that social like messaging? So I like to work through those things. And then, yeah, I just like, oftentimes what I'll do is have people, I'll look inside of someone's wardrobe and start to identify colors that they like. And we'll talk a little bit about, you know, I've done this before so many times, and colors is usually where I go wrong for myself, is like, oh, I love this, I'm going to buy this. And it's a shade of pink that just doesn't match any of the shades of pink in my wardrobe. And so it's so hard to style it. And as much, that's where I'm like, okay, maybe we draw a line and don't buy loads of this shade of pink unless you plan on building that up in your wardrobe. So like thinking about the color scheme and what actually will look nice together, like I'm a bit wild and I would totally be like, carry swatches of like, or photos of like all your other clothes. And when you're shopping, because that's like a good reminder, it's helpful to know. Anyway, there's lots of things you can do, but I think like my main thing would be to think about like good materials, making sure that when you're buying a piece, it will get used more if it feels nicer to wear. So good materials, colors that actually vibe with your whole wardrobe rather than being their own separate thing. And thinking about letting go of where you're too embarrassed to wear certain clothes if it's not a personal choice. Those would be the three things that I would say to start with if someone was trying to style themselves. But yeah, obviously there's so much to the process. I love doing it so much. It's just so fun to like, I think you get to know someone so well during the styling process. Just like, it's just such a fun, silly experience.
Yeah.
It goes to being like 14 and trying on loads of clothes in a shop.
Yeah, no, I think those points that you just mentioned are so powerful to start with, you know, for somebody who's just kind of trying to be more conscious of their choices and, you know, really handpick the pieces that go into their wardrobe or to their style of clothing. I think those points were just spot on. And I think that will really help a lot of people for sure. You mentioned a little bit about, you know, the social influence that we've had. People have, we're all influenced by media and the people around us, especially with social media right now. And the messaging they carry about style, as well as the way our bodies need to be, all of that. Is that something that has impacted you in some way, both in terms of your own style, but also in terms of how you see yourself and your body and your work towards accepting of your body?
Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, short answer, yes, obviously, you know, so much. But it's just, I recently learned something that's so fascinating. It just, it's wild how those kinds of messages keep getting compounded, no matter how much mainstream business pretends to move towards better ethics. They just find a new way to be terrible to people. Like this, I just found out that most in the industry, most quote unquote plus size models who are usually still quite low on the end of that, will, rather than hiring bigger plus size models, they ask the models to bring a kit with them of like little foam pieces to pad themselves out. So basically like a size 14 model would be padding themselves out to be the size of a size 18, so that they still have thin arms, thin ankles, and a thin neck and head. And then so that, and their body will have the exact right proportions, you know, a flat belly and a big butt, you know, all of these things. And oh, I was just like, because I think most plus size people have been looking at those photos for years being like, I have never seen somebody who is fat who also has such a flat tummy. Like, I'm sure there are people who look like that, but it must be quite a rare body type. And now we're like, what? All this time it's been this little industry trick to get away with not having to see a double chin ever, which is just mind blowing. But yeah, the way the lengths that they go, like, and you just see it, like I was saying earlier, you know, something so simple as saying that somebody shouldn't be allowed to wear color because of their skin tone. It's just like it just keeps going and going. And I feel like I always get this like warped version of social media because I kind of forget how influential it is, because I've spent so many years highly, highly, highly curating what I consume on social media to only be stuff that is like affirming and intersectional activism and like things that won't, you know, I realized I have to protect myself. Like, I'm not going to follow things that don't make me feel good about myself. And, you know, I've made a rule that I don't follow brands that don't make my size. And that in itself is difficult. And I don't really follow very many people who are smaller than my size, because I just know that it's like triggering and sad to see these amazing outfits and not be able to replicate that in my size. And for me, that's like self-preservation. But it also means that I am a member of, to some degree, the fashion industry, and I don't really know what's going on in mainstream fashion at all, because it's size exclusive. And I'm only seeing this like very filtered down version of it. So like even that, even in the way that I have created a place to not get hurt by social media, it's still not great, because, you know, I can feel that exclusion and I find a new account that's really inspiring. And I'm like, well, I can't follow this because it's going to make me feel bad, you know?
Yeah.
But there are like, that's not to say that I love fashion people of all different sizes. That's not to say that I can't be friends with a thin person. It's just like, in terms of when it's an account that's geared towards like selling clothes or like influencing about fashion, it's more that kind of thing that really I'm like, this is really difficult. And I think even that kind of thing can be quite difficult, it just goes to show how the like amped up social media celebrity, you know, someone who was on Too Hot to Handle, who's fully photoshopped their whole body and has a bunch of like, I'm not at all against plastic surgery, but you know, they have worked very hard to achieve a perfect body and are still editing it. A quote unquote perfect body and are still editing it and wearing a very specific type of clothing that's very disposable and they only wear it once. I'm like, I can totally understand how much pressure that makes people feel if that's what they're consuming on social media. But yeah, I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it definitely did. Talking about the scale of exclusion that the fashion industry has and is kind of emitting, how was it like for you growing up in terms of actually going about, you know, shopping and interacting in stores and those kind of things?
To be honest, I'm very privileged in that sense. Like, I grew up as a thin white person. And so, you know, that's not been a really difficult experience for me. And like, the more that I've met other fat people and people who've grown up fat, like I can see, and people of color and people who are disabled and can't access shops, you know, I can see how much trauma compounds from such a young age, especially in a shopping environment. Like that is one of the places where like the most harm happens to young fat people and young people who, for whatever reason, don't feel that they belong. Like my family, like I said, we were low income. So, you know, shopping wasn't super accessible to us for that reason. But I was very, very privileged in the sense that I could go into a shopping environment and feel, for the most part, like I was part of their demographic. But I think it's like, it's one of these things that I think when you are from one of the most privileged backgrounds in the world, you know, like it, the difficult realization is that when you become, if you come, so my experience is that I started out much more privileged than I have become, because I have become fat and I have become disabled, and that was not something I was born with. And it shows you quite starkly how hard it is for privileged people to realize their privilege, because there's so many things that I just didn't take on until part of it became my experience. Mm. And then I was able so much more to intersectionally realize what was going on and like being entrusted. I mean, obviously I had my kid when I was 22, so I was still quite young before that, but like, I was not so aware of how difficult it is for so many different people until I became fat and disabled. And that is like, that's a very disappointing realization to like to come to. And I think it's like, that's part of why I'm so passionate about talking to other people, especially who are in my sort of previous very privileged background of being from like, you know, white, Western, thin background, and trying to speak to those people. And because I share that experience. So, you know, it's been one of those things that's so frustrating to realize, like, a lot of people cannot understand marginalization until they become marginalized in some way. And also a lot of people won't listen about those experiences until they are being told about them by someone who comes from their same background. Those are two very disappointing things to learn, but that's why I feel very passionate about doing my kind of activism on the scale that I'm able to do it, because a good proportion of my audience are thin white women from America and the UK who have money. And I think that's just a really, it's an important audience to speak to in my position of privilege.
And I think that's a very, very interesting point. The point that, you know, people with that privilege don't necessarily see the other side of things. Do you think that's one of the biggest problems we have with, or preventing the industry from becoming more inclusive and accepting of all shapes and sizes and of all cultures and styles?
I do think so. It's like, the more that you learn about colonialism and the way that white people from colonizer countries particularly have been throughout the generations programmed to view so many groups of people as not full humans, it's astounding, because you kind of know this from, you can understand because of the social stigma that, you know, we are looking down on certain people. But the more you learn about the history, the roots of it are so insidious. It's not just about like stigma. It is like, oh no, we're trying to get to a point where we believe that people are people. And that's very hard to undo. Like, I was listening to the first episode of this podcast called Maintenance Phase yesterday. And it's about like the wellness industry and anti-fat bias and stuff. And they were saying like, oh, we wanted to make a podcast that like, we looked at all the health and wellness podcasts and we realized that they were all coming from a perspective of like, are fat people really people? Like,
oh my God.
Where it's like, do they deserve to be treated like people? Or, and like, that's actually like, I think that's a mindset that if we go back to the roots of where our stigma is coming from, with a lot of different marginalizations, it's like, and do disabled people really deserve, are they actually grown-ups or are they just children that we can tell what to do? Or like, oh, are people of color actually like the same, worth the same as a white person? You know, like these attitudes are actually, that's the root of these stigmas. And it's really, it's like, it has to be addressed, because if white people are still being trained to not see women who are garment workers, who are majority women of color, as not as human in some way or capable of dealing with certain things that, oh, you know, they can handle it because that's their lifestyle. That is like fundamentally, how are we supposed to change the fashion industry if those kind of attitudes are still in action? And it's like, the more that you learn about our history, you're like, you have to accept that this is so ingrained. And because of the way that colonization happened, people in the West are still leading these discussions. And that's why I think like, it's so exciting and important to work with companies like Akivi, because like, ideally, like I said, I don't want to have to be a person who's telling other people about this, because I'm from that same privileged background. And right now I'm like, you shouldn't just listen to me because I look like you or did at some point. Like, I'm not supposed to be the leader of this kind of movement. This is not supposed to be coming from me. That's totally inappropriate. And, you know, it just plays right back into colonialism. Like, why should I be the person who's leading and telling people to buy Indian fashion? That's so wild. So it's exciting to me to see more like you guys, like getting the opportunity to pioneer your own platform instead of it being like, oh, I've come in and curated some brands from India and you should buy from them. You know what I mean? But yeah, I think it's like, it's such a stressful situation to be in where it's just like, the attitudes are so, so ingrained from so many generations, and the power is so unequal. But that's just like, you get to a point where you're just like, I don't know how to address all of this because it's so overwhelming. But I think there is obviously, it gives you so many directions to go in.
Yeah, it's definitely a very, very large problem. And we have such amazing activists, including yourself, working in so many different ways to make some change in the industry and really, you know, kind of put your foot down and educate people about it. And I feel myself, I feel like that's such an important thing is education and really telling people that this is what it is. I myself, when we started off Ikivi, I was unaware of what was going on behind the scenes in the fashion industry. I studied fashion at FIT and we weren't really taught those things in school, but it was until I watched the movie True Cost is when I realized that there's so much, and I keep telling this story, but there's so much that you don't know. And I don't know if people will, like, you have to achieve that level of awareness and maturity, I guess, to kind of want to know more. So like, how do you, it's such a challenge to get it across, because the other person needs to want to listen as well. Because once you listen, it's very hard to make the wrong choice, you know?
Yeah. It's funny though, like the level at which people are willing to like just pretend that they don't know. Like, I remember once when I was younger, one of my friends being like, oh, I was like, oh, I like your hat. And they were like, oh, I was like, oh, where's it from? And they were like, oh, it's from Primark. It was probably made by children, I guess. And I was like, interesting that you would make that joke. Like, there's obviously like some level of guilt that you feel about this, but also like, you definitely know that this is an issue. But I think that's partially because of the way that we go about teaching people this kind of stuff. And it goes back to that like thing about white vegans who are very, you know, kind of commanding and guilting people and all this kind of stuff. And there's kind of a lot of lashing back against that culture now. But I think it's a similar thing of like, you know, it's not really helpful to just tell people that they're terrible because they're participating in the system that they've been given, you know, like it's very hard to break out of that system. And a lot of people can't because it's not affordable. And like, they didn't create a system in which they're not paid enough to afford to buy clothes where the people who make the clothes are paid enough. That's not their fault. Yeah. And so, like, I think sometimes when it's, when the activism is around making people feel only guilty, it can make that happen where people don't take any action, but they do feel bad about themselves. Mm. And it's like, well, that's not really helpful. Because yeah, people are just sad and buying fast fashion. But I think that's partially because of like that kind of narrow-minded view that the consumer is at fault for the system that exists. So like, mm-hmm, obviously we can be a lot more conscious and we can learn, and like, there's so much to learn and we do have influence. But I think from the start, making it clear that like, you know, it's okay that we were born into this world that's really, really messed up and has all of this legacy of yeah, terrible stuff. And, you know, it's okay that you didn't know about this. And it's also okay that sometimes maybe you can't be a part of the change with your money because you don't have enough. That's totally fine. But I think like the education of like being, having people learning to be critical is what I think is really important. And like some people can't afford to buy ethical fashion all the time, but learning to have a critical eye of when somebody says as if it's normal that you shouldn't wear an outfit twice, or mm-hmm, learning to look at social media in a critical way and be like, why is this person always buying clothes that cost £2 when they're a millionaire? You know,
yeah,
learning to critique the messages that they're seeing in film and TV, these like cultural touchstones that actually really perpetuate a system that kind of relies on colonialist exploitative capitalism to exist. And I think that's where then people can start making decisions that also maybe influence their politics or influence the way that they talk to other people. And that all changes the culture without even people having to change what they're spending their money on, you know, because then the culture right now is like, at least where I am, the culture is like, buy it, you want it. Here's what you want, buy it, buy
you
more.
You need it.
Yeah. Like, and that is like really hard to break away from. And then you can like take a step, if the culture changes and people are able to take a step back and be like, do I want it? Do I need it? Even that would make huge changes to the industry, you know, like that in itself, is a big change. So I think like the education being intersectional and well-rounded and not just being about fashion only, you know, having this like lens that's critical of all of the systems that are put in place, you know, like the fashion industry as it is wouldn't exist without, you know, sexism, without racism, without the political structures that we're in, without a history of colonialism and exploitation. Like all of these things aren't necessarily fashion issues, but they heavily inform why it's such a terrible system right now. So I think people like just helping people to learn to be a little bit more conscious and critical, I think is what's most important. And I try to do that in a way that also doesn't make them feel guilty and defensive, because I think that's just the way that ends up just being counterproductive sometimes. But I want to clarify that, because that argument is used against women of color all the time. And I want to say that I'm in a very privileged position, because I am a very privileged person, that I am able to adjust my tone when issues do not personally affect me. And that is not the case for everybody. And that is not mm-hmm. something that should be expected of everybody. This is my personal way of going about this kind of activism and education because of my privilege. And I think like there will be people listening who would instinctively be like, oh, okay. So when a woman of color who's directly affected by this is speaking mm-hmm. angrily about it, I'm allowed to now police their tone. And that is not what I mean at all. I think that's completely inappropriate.
Yeah.
So just yeah. to make sure that that's clear.
Yeah, no, for sure. What kind of progress do you think we've made as an industry to be more inclusive as well as conscious? According to you, like in you know, the styling kind of jobs that you do and generally what you've experienced in the last few years, what is it that has really stood out for you in terms of progress?
I think what's standing out right now is maybe not necessarily that much progress, but a lot of people wanting to seem as though they have made progress. Mm-hmm. But I think that in itself is a type of progress. And I think if that could be harnessed to actually make change, you know, so like we're seeing in the last, you know, I was similarly started to become changed about my perception on fashion because of The True Cost. You know, maybe since that movie came out, I've definitely seen a lot more greenwashing mm-hmm. and a lot more like talk about size inclusivity, even though it's not that inclusive, a lot more brands liking to use the terms inclusive and liking to use the terms ethical in a way that slightly removes all meaning from them. But, you know, that shows obviously that consumers and the culture are changing a bit to the point that brands are now scrambling to at least pretend that they're doing these things, mm-hmm. Which is definitely, that's something.
Hopefully. And I think
that, yeah, I think what needs to happen then is that's where the education comes in, you know, for people to be able to be critical, to have learned to have a critical eye for these things and be like, is this actually ethical? Is this actually sustainable? Is this actually inclusive? Or are you just slapping that as a brand, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think if this kind of culture shift that's beginning to be hinted at is like harnessed and critiqued and pushed forward by consumers, I think there's potential to be a lot of progress. And I do see in like, in sustainable fashion, there's definitely more labels that are catering to bigger bodies and stuff like that. I think like, it's very difficult to have a perfect brand. And I think that sometimes puts people off from trying because they get a bit too stressed out or whatever.
Yeah.
But I think for me, sometimes when I speak about things, people are like, oh, you're so negative. You know, there's so yeah. many problems. And I'm like, to me, that doesn't actually feel like negativity. I'm excited when I critique the system. And I'm excited that, you know, there's never going to be an end to my personal growth. Like, I'm not bothered. I think I can accept that I'm never going to be perfect and be inspired by the fact that there's always room to grow. And I think like reframing, I think culturally the idea of being perfect is still really highlighted and it's just never going to be possible. And I think like what I want to see is people moving away from the idea of being perfect and moving towards the idea of being like excited and inspired by change and, you know, accepting that, you know, you can, I don't know, like it's that guilt of like, oh, I guess a child made it. That instead of being like, you know, I bought this and I'm hoping next time I can save up and buy something better because I've got this hat now, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And not just living in fear of saying the wrong thing or buying the wrong thing and just being like, you know what? I can apologize and move on and learn to be better, or not even apologize because that was where I was at the time. If it's, I didn't yeah. know, you know? So I don't know. I think there's a lot of potential for change. And I'm tentative about saying there's loads of change, but it is nice. Like definitely in the last few years, I can see more brands doing my size anyway.
Yeah. No, I think that's so powerful. The idea of progress over perfection and really being kind with yourself to, you know, allowing that progress to take place and really being conscious and aware of it and continuing to make progress, because I don't think we'll ever be perfect. But I think it's just about the attitude towards that, just being more willing to learn and willing to make changes in your own life. I think that itself has so much, is such a big takeaway from what you just said. What do you think is something that is holding brands back towards and not making necessarily the change towards being more inclusive as a brand or conscious?
I think a lot of that is just like the expectations of the like mainstream fashion system and capitalism and mass production. Like, I think what a lot of brands are realizing is like, you can't run a fashion brand in the way that the fashion world expects and be inclusive and be ethical. Those things are almost like in complete opposition to each other. So like, I see a lot of companies being like, we have to make so much stock. If we make 5 more sizes, we're going to run out of money because our margins are so low. Or like, you know, and I'm like, well, why are your margins so low? That's not, that means it doesn't work. or being like, oh, we can't afford this better fabric because we need to have this price point and all of these things. And it's like, or we need to produce 1,000 of each item in order to be able to work with this factory, you know? And I'm like, okay, well, I don't think you should produce 1,000 of each item, but
yeah, capitalism and greed.
Yeah. Like you'll see a lot of the brands who have a very extensive size range are made to order or do pre-order systems or do like, you know, half pre-order, half made to order, half ready to ship, you know, like they take a kind of critical look at the way that they should be producing. And maybe they do 2 collections in a year instead of 4, and, or just once every few years, you know, not being so beholden to the fashion calendar or mass production and things like that. But that's very hard. And I think what's really difficult is that it's small brands who are taking the pressure of that. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like with small business, a lot of the time when they say they can't afford something, they really can't afford it. And that's a really difficult place to be because, you know, it should be fast fashion who are, or like big fashion people who have loads of money who are like creating the system and the resources to make these things accessible because they've got all the money, mm-hmm. not small brands like desperately paying out of pocket to like make these things happen. And like the resources are hard to find. Like plus size fashion grading is very difficult to find. Like you'll probably know from fashion school, there's nothing about that. And you know, it's just like not addressed and not really like taught. And so a lot of people come out of it like, I don't actually know where to find this information, but no investment is going into creating courses that are better, and no investment is creating resources that are open source or accessible.
Yeah.
So I think like it's very difficult. There's like there needs to be so much pressure on bigger businesses, but I think also on schools, like I have this whole like dream of creating some kind of fund for like somebody to do a PhD or something similar on like plus size grading, and for it to eventually be open source so that it could be something that everybody could access and it could be funded by the community in some way. But I have no idea how to organize that kind of thing. But that's like the kind of thing that I wish more, like wish would happen more often, like paying people who are very skilled to create resources that can be open source. Because I think a lot of the time when people invest so much money in their own resources, then they're rightfully quite protective of it. Cause they're like, you know, I spent so much time and so much money making this. I don't really want other people to take it and not have to do it, you know, but that's, I don't know. I think there are a lot of great people doing amazing open source stuff now. And, you know, hopefully we're working towards a community that's less protective. I don't know if you know, I'm sure you do, Slow Factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way that they do their lectures very openly and ask like payment if you can afford it. And I'm friends with some people who run a thing called Zero Waste Design Online. Mm-hmm. And they also are trying to make their resources open source and inclusive and, you know, working towards a system in which they can, once they've paid off themselves, then it can be open to the public. So that's another kind of thing that I think could make a lot of change in fashion is if stuff is available.
I think so, because we've been having conversations with the brands that we have and we have on board, and it is difficult in terms of figuring out sizing, and they are not taught that in school. So they don't want it to also affect their brands, because if they don't do it correctly, then there's no point of doing it, right? So mm-hmm. I think it's definitely something that's been on our mind as well, where we want to kind of offer this to designers and, you know, help with education in terms of how does that happen? How do you size differently and what goes into the making of it? Because that is something that is seriously lacking in the fashion industry for sure. So if you are at some point going to conduct a course yourself or know anybody who is, we're all yours.
It's funny. Like, I think with a lot of stuff about like inclusivity, it's a genuine double truth. And one truth is genuinely that people do not care and don't really want to bother. And, you know, it's not their dream client base and they genuinely don't have access to these things. So I do think, like, at least if there's the capability to change minds about who can be a fashion customer and who can wear certain clothes and stuff like that, then that will just hopefully naturally create a push for more education and more desire to teach this and to learn it. So hopefully.
Yeah, hopefully. Lovely. So my last question to you is, do you have any exciting new projects coming up this year? And is there something you'd like to share with us?
Well, I did say I'm working on some knitting patterns. I think I have like 3 or 4 on the go right now. So that's pretty exciting for me. And it means that people can start making their own versions of my designs, which is really exciting. But I can't really speak about them too much, but I have a couple of like design collaborations coming out with a couple of small brands. I would love to do more of that. It's so exciting. and yeah, just like, I don't know, just I've got a lot of ideas, which is always very exciting, but I'm always full of ideas.
So exciting. We're always excited to see what you do and love following the work that you do. Thank you for being on this podcast episode. And I'm so excited for it to go up and excited for people to listen in.
Thank you so much. This has been really nice.
If you enjoyed this conversation, don't forget to subscribe to the Ikivi podcast, a space for discussion on living meaningful and fuller lives each day. The Ikivi podcast is a property edited and produced by the team at Ikivi.